Chapter 4. Teaching. Too much instead of too little. Christian Science teaching is being done at this period, for the Spirit is lacking. The world must gradually grow up to this great fact of being, and the study of science and health with personal experience and individual growth is better adapted to this end. Mary B. G. Eddy. 1889. Truth uncovers error, and the spirituality which Mrs. Eddy brought to the New York scene had far-reaching effects. One of the first exposures appeared in Mrs. Plunkett's magazine, the International Magazine of Christian Science. This attractive publication first appeared in July 1888 as a merger of her Truth, a Magazine of Christian Science, and Luther Marston's Mental Healing Monthly. The latter, however, with its 1,800 subscribers, was soon absorbed by the High Priestess, as was Albert Dorman's Messenger of Truth, with 1,500 more subscribers shortly thereafter. The International published a special notice on the 3rd of April. Over the signatures of John J. T. Plunkett and Mary H. Plunkett appeared an announcement of their divorce, without regard for the laws of the land. It stated in part, quote, "We, therefore, from the most profound conviction of duty, do jointly declare our marriage contract null and void. The Truth has made us free." End quote. This brought forth from Mrs. Eddy's pen an article in the June Journal entitled Conjugal Rights. It was about the year 1875 when science and health first crossed swords with free love, and the latter fell hors du combat. But the warfare was not ended. The book that cast the first stone is still at work deeply down in human consciousness, laying the axe at the root of error. We have taken the precaution of writing briefly on the above topics to show the relation of marriage to Christian Science. In the present or future, some extra throw of error, ready for copyright, may conjure up a new style, conjugality, which, ad libitum, severs the marriage covenant, puts virtue in the shambles, and coolly notifies the public of broken vows. Springing up from the ashes of free love, this nondescript phoenix, in the face and eyes of common law, common sense, and common honesty, may appear in the role of a superfine morality, but having no truth, it will have no past, present, or future. It is seen already in Christian Science that the gospel of marriage is not without the law, even the solemn vow of fidelity, until death do us part, and this verity in human economy can neither be obscured nor throttled. Mrs. Eddy's statement that some extra throw of error may conjure up a new style conjugality was very timely. On the rare occasions when the International Christian Scientist had mentioned the name of Mary Baker Eddy, it had been in the most casual manner. Science and Health was merely one book in its list of 50 for suggested reading, with no indication whatsoever that it had any more importance than bread pills or esoteric Christianity, to mention but two of the other 49 titles. In the July issue of 1889, Mrs. Plunkett made quite a change. She quoted extensively from Science and Health in a 14 and one-half page defense of her actions, and she also published a statement declaring that even though the press persistently called her the High Priestess of Christian Science, she was only an earnest and grateful student of Mary Baker Eddy. All this may have been revenge for Mrs. Eddy's conjugal rights, and it surely was the endeavor to place upon Mrs. Eddy's shoulders the responsibility for another statement, which was published in this July issue. This statement, signed by A. Bentley Worthington and Mary Bentley Worthington, was an announcement of a spiritual marriage. Without the formality of a legal divorce or marriage, Mrs. Plunkett had taken a new husband and assumed the name of Worthington. In a statement to the New York Press on the 28th of July, she said, quote, "When Mr. Worthington came into my presence, I knew instantly that he was my conjugal mate," end quote. The leader in the Christian Science Journal for July was by Mrs. Eddy and was entitled Fallibility of Human Concepts. The article began, "Evil counterfeits good. It says, 'I am truth,' when it is a lie. It says, 'I am love,' but love is spiritual, and sensuous love is material. Wherefore, it is hate instead of love. For the five senses give man pain, sickness, sin, and death, pleasure that is false, life that leads unto death, joy that becomes sorrow. Love that is not the procurator of happiness declares itself the antipodes of love, and love punishes the joys of this false sense of love, chastens its affection, purifies it, and turns it into the opposite channels." In 1877, Mr. and Mrs. Eddy had truly had a spiritual marriage, but they had neither publicized that fact nor disregarded the laws of the land. However, marriage was not the pressing problem to be solved in the leader's present experience. The problem facing her was the incorrect and uninspired teaching that was flooding the land. A solution to this problem was essential to the founding of Christian Science, that her wonderful discovery be not lost again to the world. Every step she had taken had been imitated and perverted by students, until she despaired that mankind would ever learn that God is the great I Am. All over this great nation, mortal minds were claiming that I am God. On the 5th of March, in her leave-taking address to the primary class just completed, she had said, "I must speak to you this morning, my dear students, of rocks and sirens that are in your course, on which so many wrecks are made. I must tell you of some of the doors that animal magnetism opens for the entrance of the enemy, sometimes just at the moment when you are ready to enter on the fruition of your labors, just when you are about to chant hymns of victory for triumphs. The open doors most often used are those of rivalry, jealousy. It is the I itself, I, the inside and outside, the what and the why, the when and the where, the low and the high, all I itself, I." The class to which she had addressed these words had met on the 25th of February and was the largest class yet to be held at the Massachusetts Metaphysical College. Nearly 70 students had assembled on that day, including an interesting young couple from Dakota named Nixon, who would play a prominent role in the future of the movement. Also in this class were a number of students who had studied with the teacher previously, including Mr. and Mrs. Edward P. Bates, Mrs. Augusta E. Stetson, Mr. and Mrs. Edward A. Kimball, Joshua Bailey, and his son Frank, the former having just been made editor of the journal. The teacher had also stated in her parting address, "My only earthly pride is my students. I learned long ago that the world could deprive me of nothing, nor give me anything, and I have only one joy and one pride left. It is my students. If I cherish this pride unwisely, I know that I shall be chastened for it." She loved and cherished her students, but she was beginning to feel that her duty was to leave them to their own devices and let them learn from experience. They leaned very heavily upon their teacher, but would not or could not follow her lead and her advice. She told William B. Johnson that she found it difficult to sleep at night because so many wonderful things, ways, means, and results at which the world would marvel, kept coming to her. These were ever developing in her thought, but she did not dare utter one word of them, because the revelation might shake the faith of even the few loyal students in Boston who were left to work with her. Wonderful visions of her church, the structure of truth and love, were unfolding in her thought. But whenever she endeavored to implement progressive steps, her students chemicalized and left her. Even now, the Boston Christian Scientists, who had deserted her nearly a year earlier, were still holding the association records ransom and demanding for their return honorable dismission from the Christian Scientists Association. But to her March primary class, she introduced one progressive step that had been revealed to her. At the March 5th leave-taking, after answering a question, she went on to state, "I want to say, too, to my students everywhere, whether they have attended my classes or have received instruction through reading my books, that they can become members of the Mother Church here in Boston and be received into its communion by writing without their personal presence. If you are united with us in thought and affection, you know in science that you are not absent from us. I carry you all in my affection." And now she intended keeping all her students in her affection and removing herself from their personal presence in Boston. To this end, she had sent Dr. Foster Eddy to Vermont to find a suitable residence. One of the many letters to students written before her departure was to a new student, Reverend D. A. Easton. "Allow me, my dear student, to say, if you will make a study of science and health for 1 month and go through the book as you would any textbook in college, it will be of great advantage to you." Reverend Easton, together with his wife and daughter, had been in Mrs. Eddy's primary class just completed, and they were also among the fortunate few to obtain room and board at the Massachusetts Metaphysical College during the course of instruction. Emma Easton, the daughter, described the teacher, "Our leader's appearance at that time was of a woman many years younger than the recorded number, The hair was still dark, the eyes glowing with the inner fire of spiritual inspiration. The delicate complexion permitted her color to vary in response to her thought. In the 19th century, a person over 50 was considered aged, and Mrs. Eddy was in her 68th year. Her youthful appearance was phenomenal, but her students placed heavy burdens upon her, and the trials of 1888 and 1889 were exacting a heavy toll. She had written of this and of the poor teaching in the field to her student, John Filbert, a few days after the March class was dismissed. "I do not want to teach. I am tired, tired of teaching and being the slave of so many minds. But I had rather there would never be a teacher but the Bible and science and health than that such poor teaching should go on." A new primary class at the college early in May was taught by Dr. Foster Eddy. This was followed by a normal class, which convened May 21st, and this class, too, the teacher entrusted to her son, while she removed to the Pleasant House he had found for her in Barre, Vermont. The only students she took with her were her secretary and housekeeper, Calvin Fry and Martha Morgan. For some time, the college advertisement in the journal had described the four courses offered: primary, normal, metaphysical obstetrics, and science of theology. Though the class in theology had been advertised monthly for several years, it had never been taught. So there was great interest in a special notice in the May journal. Massachusetts Metaphysical College Special Notice. All students who wish to go through the entire course at the Massachusetts Metaphysical College should send in their applications early for admission to the other classes, and thus be ready for the opening of the theological class. Notice is also given that after the coming primary class, no students who have been under the instruction of any other teacher, whether a normal student of the Massachusetts Metaphysical College or not, will be received. This notice is positive and final. This notice clearly says that students who had been instructed by others were not as teachable as those who had studied science and health on their own. Even her own best normal students were interfering with the receptive thought that science and health was leavening. And the enemy was imitating and endeavoring to outdistance the leader, claiming to teach all that she did. No sooner had she announced her theological class than these imitators did the same, as is evident in a letter from a practitioner teacher which appeared in the June journal. It read in part, "A class in the theology of Christian Science is advertised in Galveston if there can be a sufficient number gotten together who have already taken the primary course. Now this teacher comes in and offers to teach the last course to my own and other students who have never had time to demonstrate what they know from the primary course. Letters have been exhibited in support of these pretensions that are supposed to have been written by our teacher, and which make people think that she endorsed the proceeding. This has caused discord with some of my students, as I have told them no one but our teacher was permitted to teach this course." The teacher had not even set a date for the theology class, which she had been waiting years to teach, and usurpers were already claiming to teach it in her name and with her blessing. That was not the only thing to invade the peace and quiet of the vacation she was seeking in Vermont. The town band in Barre had begun summer concerts in the square just outside her window, and the daily practicing, more than the concerts, shattered the restful atmosphere she had sought. So in June, she moved with her household to 62 North State Street in Concord, New Hampshire. False teachers were spreading faulty teaching of Christian Science far and wide. But they were building upon sand, not upon the rock, Christ. Sooner or later, they and their teaching were destined to fall, and one of the most flagrant fell sooner. Before the end of July, A. Bentley Worthington was exposed by New York newspapers as an embezzler who had been eluding the law for many years. They stated that his name was probably not Worthington, that he had fled from one place after another when his past had caught up with him, and that he had several living wives in as many different locations, and at least one abandoned child. Almost overnight, the High Priestess lost her credibility and most of her followers. In August, Mrs. Plunkett stood amidst the ruins of her empire, and by the end of 1889, the International Christian Science Association and the International Magazine of Christian Science had ceased to exist. Soon thereafter, Mrs. Plunkett moved to Australia and came to an ignominious end by committing suicide. Emma Hopkins had severed her relationship with Mrs. Plunkett following the spiritual divorce, but continued teaching her version of Christian Science, like many another of the discoverer's early students, without practicing the ethics of Christian Science. Over a year earlier, in March of 1888, Mrs. Eddy had written in the journal of these students, and of Emma Hopkins in particular, "Things to be thought of. The science is hampered by immature demonstrations, by the infancy of its discovery, by incorrect teaching, and especially by some unprincipled claimants, whose mad ambition drives them to appropriate my ideas and discovery without credit, appreciation, or a single original conception, while they quote from other authors every random thought in line with mine. This dishonesty, yea, fraud, is conspicuous in the verbose lectures of Mrs. Emma Hopkins. She adopts my ethics or talks them freely while departing from them. Her injustice to her teacher and benefactor, to one who tenderly rescued her from unnameable conditions, and then, to spare vanity a blow, receipted in full the bill for her tuition, without ever receiving a cent. This ingratitude is startling to those who know it all." Mrs. Hopkins had gained much from her teacher, in addition to the free tuition, and she continued to impart this knowledge for the rest of her days. She was extremely capable and could have done a great work for the world if she could have but resisted the malicious malpractice that separated her from the discoverer and founder. As it was, she was very influential in the numerous offshoots from Christian Science, and has been referred to in this area as the teacher's teacher. Among her students were Charles and Myrtle Fillmore, founders of Unity School of Christianity, and Ernest Holmes, founder of Church of Religious Science. As late as 1893, Mrs. Hopkins was still calling her school in Chicago the Christian Science Theological Seminary, but eventually she ceased using the name Christian Science, as did most of her students and followers. Her influence was far more lasting than was that of her partner, Mary Plunkett, but it too is destined to fade into oblivion. For she forsook the Revelator to this age and forgot the words she herself had penned about her teacher and leader. In other words, quote, "No student, I speak from knowledge of the facts, has ever yet been qualified to teach Christian Science, except rudimentarily, but she whose life of cleansing sorrow left her the fit transparency for revelation straight from the infinite source, teaches the science of God and His creations in all its divine completeness. No member of a class of the college ever left till he had ascended the full height of his understanding, borne thither by the strong pinions of our leader's inspiration." End quote. Mrs. Eddy had had much to meet from the rebellious students from the time of Richard Kennedy's perversion of her discovery in 1871. And in the spring of 1889, the teaching of Christian Science in the field was driving her once again into the wilderness. The students in the May Normal class were disappointed that only the opening lecture had been given by the teacher, but all Christian Scientists were stunned by a notice in the June journal. Special notice from Reverend Mary B. G. Eddy. In accordance with a long-cherished intention, I hereby announce my retirement from active labors as teacher at the Massachusetts Metaphysical College. This institution will be supplied with competent teachers. I have already placed the Christian Science Journal in other hands and resigned the pastorage of the Church of Christ Scientist, Boston. This change is made for two reasons. First, because my duties have accumulated to such a degree, and I believe my students should and can fill these positions themselves. Second, to fulfill other duties that demand both my attention and retirement. The duties that demanded her attention were means and methods for the salvation of Christian Science. The purity of her sacred discovery was becoming tarnished by the impurity and immaturity of the teachers in the field. The poor teaching that was going on was diluting the science of being, humanizing and emasculating her divine discovery. In the summer of 1889, her loyal students posed almost as grave a problem as did the disloyal ones. To whom could she turn for help? Like her brother in Galilee, she must go up into a mountain apart to pray. Her retirement from the world was necessary, that she might commune with God. Her mission was to lead the children of Israel, Christ's offspring, into the promised land of Christian Science, and only God could outline and guide her footsteps.